specialties in subsurface robotic exploration and analog missions here on Earth. Chris is a very interesting guy. He's a world explorer. He's been involved with polar research since 1980, traveling to the Antarctic dry valleys of the Siberian and Canadian Arctic to conduct research in those Mars-like environments. He's also been in the high Andes, where he dove into the highest lake on Earth, situated in the caldera of a volcano. Much of what we learned about the mitigation efforts for the moon dust could be applied as well to Mars, so the organization committee decided to have Chris come and talk and get sort of a comparative neurology of the moon and Mars. Chris?
Okay, thanks, Russ. And what I want to do is discuss what we know about the soil and dust on Mars in the context of comparing it to what we heard Dave McKay, my younger brother David, went in earlier. He was the black sheep of the family. Interested in going to the moon. What we heard about the lunar dust and how there might be some connection. Can I get the next slide? I'll try to control those. I want to, roughly speaking, cover three topics. One is, what can we learn about Mars dust on the moon? As Terry said in her introductory talk, one of the rationales for going to the moon is to prepare for future human exploration of Mars. So it would be handy if the systems we developed for dust mitigation and control on the moon also worked on Mars. And so try to indirectly address that. And the way we'll do that is by discussing what do we know about the physical, chemical, and biological properties of Mars dust. We've learned a lot from the missions that have gone there. And then I'll talk a little bit about future measurement needs. What might we be doing in addition to going to the moon that might help us understand Mars? So as we heard this morning, on the moon and on Mars, fundamental source of the soil is commutated basaltic rock. You grind up the rock, and that's the starting point. That's where the similarity ends, though. As we heard from Dave on the moon, subsequent processing is due to space weathering in an extreme vacuum. Whereas on Mars, the further alteration is much more complex. It's due to atmosphere and wind, ice, water, and brines, oxidation, volcanic gases, and possibly, we don't know, life. These processes have been operating on the moon. In a sense, probably the best analog, as I'll talk about, for Mars dust is probably Earth, where a lot of these processes also are active. But we can't really do a mission to Earth to prepare for going to go to Mars. Next slide, please. Okay, here we go. The most striking feature about dust on Mars is that it makes dust storms. We see these from Earth. We've known this for a long time. That there's enough dust on Mars, and the atmosphere is active enough for the dust to be kicked up and transported globally, and it changes the face of Mars, even viewed from Earth. And this is the Hubble pictures, sort of before and after, showing a dust storm. So dust is a very different phenomenon on Mars, and we've known that for a long time. Here's the dust storm scene from the Viking lander sites. Different Martian days, Marcus Soles, corrected so that you're getting some rough idea of the opacity, and you can see it doesn't have to be rocket science to pick out which one is the dust storm. It's this one right here. The optical depth at the Viking lander sites during the intense dust storm was 5 optical depths. So that's that would be the direct transmission of the solar beam during a 5 optical depth dust storm would be less than 1%. Now, that doesn't mean that the light levels would be less than 1%, because there's a lot of scattering. It would be analogous to a cloudy day on Earth, where you can't see the sun, but there's still light because it's scattered by the clouds. So although the optical depth of the dust storm can be quite high, the surfaces are black. And as we know from Viking and from the MER missions, that there's water on Mars, evidence for water in the past, such as these features, and water frost as a transient phenomenon. Frost is condensing at the Viking site, and then evaporate, so water comes and goes. So we know a lot about the processes that are influencing Martian dust. I want to talk for a minute about where the fundamental data we have. There's really two sources. We do not have return samples, unfortunately, from Mars, and we haven't sent humans or other life forms to Mars. The data we get comes from two sources. One is from the Martian meteorites. We do have rocks on Earth that have come from Mars, surprisingly. This is the most famous, the Allen Hills 84-00 run. It's a rock. We have some dozen or so rocks on Earth that have come from Mars. We know they've come from Mars because on the side of them, there's a little plaque that says made in Mars. No, because inside the meteorites, there are little gas bubbles, and those bubbles contain Mars air. Not Earth air or Venus air or Jupiter air, they contain Mars air. And there's other mineralogical and elemental isotopic indications that these rocks come from Mars. So that's a valuable in-hand sample. We don't really know how representative they are of the rocks in general on Mars, and none of the rocks, except for one that the MER missions explored, were really similar to the meteorites. But still, these are rocks in hand, and they are from Mars, so they represent an important source of information about the bedrocks on Mars. And then the other bit of information we have on Mars comes from the X-ray fluorescence instruments that have flown on Viking, Pathfinder, and the two MER rovers. Essentially the same instrument has flown on all the landed missions, and that is an X-ray fluorescence. An alpha proton system was added later, and what it gives us is elemental distribution. It tells us the elements on the surface of Mars. And from that we try to infer the mineralogy and the history of the soils and how they form. This just shows an interesting example showing two places in the Eagle Crater, showing that the elemental distribution of sulfur is very different between these two sites. There are some variations in the soils. In this case, a lot more sulfur in one, a lot less in the other, presumably due to some sort of transport of salts, sulfate salts, by water moving through the desert soil here. What do we learn from the elemental analysis at these two Viking lander sites, the Pathfinder site and the two Mir sites? So we have five successful missions at five different locations on Mars. We can compare them. This chart is from a paper by Larry Soderbaum et al. Showing just in one dimension, one set of parameters, how these soils compare. And you can see the Viking soils marked by these X's, Pathfinder soils, the Gusev soils, which are the opportunity over the Gusev crater sites, Spirit rover, and then opportunity here in with the red circles. You see they all cluster together, and they do here, compared to the salt-rich surface materials, which are clearly been enhanced in sulfate. These arrows indicate end members, if you will, in this diagram of sulfur versus iron and lead, some reference. The salts are down here, near the rocks, and there's the rich hematite concretions, and then the sulfates there. Those are mixtures of materials, but the soils all cluster here together, pretty much the same soil everywhere on the planet. That's going to be, I think, a robust conclusion that the soil, presumably the dust, is going to be the same everywhere on the planet. Here's another diagram showing the same things, the soils cluster. And that the soils are different from the rocks. Soils are the same everywhere on the planet, they're different from the rocks. As Dave pointed out, the moon can't get the Mars soil by just taking either the Martian meteorites or the rocks that we see in the at the sites that we've landed and grinding them up. You don't get the Mars soil by simply doing that. You get the next slide, please. So this chart I've tried to summarize what are the key physical properties of the Mars soil. Give up. First, unlike the case for the lunar soil, we have no direct data for the very small size particles. The microscopic imager on the MER missions gave us our best images of the soil, equivalent to hand lens, geologists' hand lens imaging. But its resolution is pixel size is 30 microns. So we really don't have any direct data for the very tiny particles, the dust particles. You can't see, really. We haven't seen the dust particles, where dust is defined, as David did this morning, as particles less than 20 microns. know they're there because that's what's suspended in the atmosphere. The stuff floating in the air is just dust particles, so we know they're there. We just don't, we have no direct data on their size and shape. But unlike the moon, dust on Mars is likely to be physically weathered due to wind transport. The stuff is being blown around, mixed. So shards or long, thin slivers of particles like you saw in the case of the moon are likely, more likely to be weathered, physically weathered, mechanically weathered particles. This is a guess based on what we expect, because we haven't actually finished them yet. We haven't seen the particles. From the elemental analysis at these five sites now, we have elemental analysis at five sites. The soil is similar at those five sites. We have no reason to expect that there's toxic metals in the soil. There's not high concentrations of anything bizarre. Again, similar to what we heard about the moon. There's not high concentrations of something of a toxic heavy metal. I'll talk about later the evidence for the presence of oxidants and the absence of organics. This is probably the most unusual feature of the Mars soil. It fizzes when you add water to it. Fizzes and releases oxygen and it consumes organics. That's an unusual property. But other than that, the soil is probably what we'd expect to find in many deserts on Earth. Next slide. The dust on Mars moves. And it is sorted by size. You can see that very nicely in these pictures of dust devils, where dust devil tracks, small tornadoes are moving across the surface, and they're presumably moving away to find material, leaving the darker material below. So what we're seeing when you look at the surface here, presumably what we're seeing is a surface in which the very fine particles from the dust storm have settled down. And they are smaller, lighter carbon material. The dust storm comes, or the dust devil comes and sweeps that away, leaving the darker track. So there's darker material underneath the lighter material. This represents not a compositional difference as much as a size difference with the fine dust at the surface. Next slide, please. We can see the dust and that's mobility very nicely on the rovers. Both rovers experience what they're calling cleaning events, where the dust seems to build up and then is gone after a while, presumably by the same sort of process of dust devil or wind gust that's removing the sand, although an alternative explanation could be that frost is acting as a cleaning agent. This is a target, a sundial target, and you can see here it is, and here it is 5 days later after a cleaning event. These have been observed on both rovers now, and particularly for Opportunity, they're providing enough cleaning of the solar panels that the power levels are back to the original start of mission level. So it's an important effect here that the dust on these surfaces doesn't just accumulate indefinitely, but is cleaned by these early wind events. And this is not believed to be due to any motion of the rover. It means if you were to put a static solar panel up at this sort of height, then it, dust would not accumulate on it, indefinitely. It would accumulate on it for a while, but then there would be these cleaning events, which dust of wind or transport remove the dust. It doesn't necessarily mean that the surface doesn't necessarily need to be angled, although that presumably would help. Next slide.
No brush marks.
No brush marks. Or would it be for a hand from here? Well, the total column mass during a dust storm is quite small, and during the Viking mission, they recorded probably the largest dust storm observed by any of the landed vehicles. That was the Alphabet 5. And after the dust storm, they looked out to see if they could see dust on any of the rocks or see if they could detect the coating. And it was undetectable. Because the layer of dust, the amount of dust in the air is optically thick, but in terms of column amount, it's still very, very low. I don't know if we can quantify it, but they are kicking up a lot. You can see in the tracks that they are disturbing the dust. And the different this picture in a sense gets at that. And the different sites they kick up more. This is an interesting observation of the two landers, Gusev crater, two MER vehicles that they landed. Gusev crater, they kicked up a lot of dust. and the airbags were dirty. It's hard to see it here, but if you look at the color part of this picture, these are the airbags sticking out from underneath the vehicle. Remember, a Pathfinder and the two MER landers both bounced on airbags. And when they landed, the airbags were underneath the platform, and the first images that they took, you could see the airbags. On Pathfinder and at Gusev Craters, the airbags were dirty. They had reddish dust on them. So that was dust from landing and being picked up from the lander. Whereas at Eagle Crater, the airbags were clean. And in fact, that's consistent with the surface of Eagle Crater being darker and having less fine dust. At Eagle Crater, the surface seems to be like those dust devil surfaces, blown clean of the fine dust. So that here, the hypothesis is that the persistent winds are strong enough to winnow out the fine material, leaving a larger size, almost desert pavement. And this happens a lot in deserts on Earth. The wind blows clear the fine material and leaves a mantle of rocks and heavier material called the desert pavement. In some sense, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but Eagle Crater has a desert pavement. There's no fine dust at the surface, so the bounces, the airbags are clean. When the rover started moving, it broke through that desert pavement and exposed fine dust and kicked it up, and things did get dirty. So the rover, so again, this reminded me of what Jack Schmidt was saying this morning, which is that the activity is going to create dust. And that's definitely true at, for example, sites like Eagle Crater. This is not a naturally dusty place, but if you start walking around, you break the desert pavement, and that exposes dust deep below, which is similar to what the tanks did in the Mojave. You still go out and see the traces where they broke the desert crust in the Mojave, and the soils are much more fragile after that crust has been broken. Really the same thing is happening here. This illustrates the point that even though the composition is the same at all these sites, that doesn't mean that the dust properties are the same. As I was saying earlier, the elemental analysis at all these sites indicates that this stuff is the same as that stuff, but the sorting and the size distribution here is different than here. Here you have light, fine dust in the environment. Here you've got a heavier sand material covering the surface.
Chris, I forgot to mention it, but the lunar descent engine, F-1s, did the same thing underneath the rim, and for some distance away from it. It winnowed the fine particles away from the surface and changed the optical rock.
Right.
So you can see that by the light little spots around the rim.
That's interesting. So here the wind is naturally going over a large area. Next slide, please. Here is a very interesting, I think the most interesting thing we learned from the MER missions, and again directly relevant to the lunar analysis, which is that virtually all Martian airborne dust is magnetic, and an area can be kept clear with magnetic fields. And this is not just a supposition, this is actually demonstrated with the sweep magnet on the two rovers. And here's a picture of the sweep magnet, and the picture shows three fields. This dust ring, a clear area in here, and then this outer ring. In the three fields, the ring of dust is the where the dust or magnetized particles would be directed due to the shape of the magnetic field. So falling magnetic particles are deflected to fall in that donut ring. That's the ring of dust is the magnetic particles. And you can see that it's got the strong absorption down in there. In the blue, containing an iron rich, that's the dust, sure enough. The outer ring is free of magnetic fields at all, so this is just a passive surface in which dust is falling. And there is dust on this outer ring as well, which is the outside of the magnet field. You see that there is some dust, obviously not as much as the inner ring. What's interesting is that the center circle was designed to catch non-magnetic particles. The only thing that's going to make it into the center circle is non-magnetic particles, and there is no dust at all. It is as clean as the brush polished aluminum. There is no dust at all in that center part. In fact, the authors of this study, this paper just published in Science, I apologize, I don't have the reference to it. The authors of the study claim that this is the cleanest spot on the entire rover field because it's being magnetically shielded. So, remember, this morning we were talking about the lunar fine dust is also being virtually all magnetic particles. So the could be that this is what the Mars and the Moon have in common, is that the fine particles are magnetic. So if we develop a strategy, a dust mitigation and handling strategy, magnetic dust intakes, they should work on Mars as well as on the Moon. Both very magnetic. Possibly, I guess I didn't mention it, but here the magnetic material is magnetic. I don't know if that's what it is on the Moon. It's not metallic iron. Okay. But it should, in principle, the same. It should be the same thing. It should work.
The pair type is
so that's, I think, the best news from the rover missions was that the dust on Mars is as magnetic as on the Moon. The most puzzling news is the Viking results of the oxygen in the soil. I'm going to go back to Viking. Remember, Viking scooped up some soil, and it is the only experiments that have been done on Mars so far in which water has been added to the soil. In fact, it's the only experiments in which we really manipulated the soil. The rovers that have gone since then have been able to measure the soil by placing instruments up against them, but we have not yet had a mission that successfully dug and pulled up samples and stuck them in jars and things like that. So Viking is still the best data we have on the properties of the soil in the sense of biological interesting properties. Next slide. And remember the Viking biology experiments, there were three experiments. I'm only going to talk about two of them, which are the interesting ones, the labeled release and the gas exchange. Because in these two experiments, water was added to the soil. And that's the key. And when soil gets trampled into the habitat, what the change that it's going to experience is being brought into the moist environment in which humans live. When we breathe in soil, it's going to be interacting with the moist environment within the body. So adding water to the soil is, in a sense, the relevant biological simulation. And Viking did that. And the results were a shocker. Next slide. What were the results? The first result was that when the soil was merely humidified, not even drenched, but just humidified in the GEX experiment, oxygen was released. So add water, oxygen is released. That was unexpected. In the LR experiment, when nutrients were added to the soil, CO2 was released. That was expected. That was the way that experiment was going to search for life. But that was in direct conflict with the GCMS results, which failed to detect organics in the soil at all at the levels of parts per million. So these are the three puzzles that came from the Viking results. Oxygen released when the soil was leaded. CO2 was consumed from organics. We know that the CO2 came from the organics because they were radioactively labeled. And no organics in the soil at all at a level too low to be consistent with meteoritic infall or in situ production. I'm going to skip this because I'm going to go into more detail on these, how we can estimate how much oxygen this represents. But I'm going to go into these results in a little more detail. Next slide, please. The gas exchange experiment. Oxygen was released on humidification. The soil was merely exposed to water vapor in the headspace above the solution. And as a result of that interaction with water vapor, oxygen was released at quantities that varied by an order of magnitude, from 70 to 770 nanomoles per cubic centimeter. You can calculate what that corresponds in terms of mass weight of some oxidant being decomposed, like, say, potassium peroxide. It corresponds to 3 to 35 parts per million by mass. So it's a potent oxidant. It's releasing oxygen, but it's at very, very low levels. Very low levels. Much less oxidation potential here than we have on Earth in this room, or you gargle with it. Use hydrogen peroxide solution at a safe one, that's 3%. There is a warning that pollute by water, 1.5%. We're talking parts per million. Now, the puzzling, one of the things about the gas exchange experiment was that the reactivity was unaltered by heating. The sample was sterilized, and it still was reacting. So whatever was causing this reaction was immune to being decomposed by heating, and it varied by an order of magnitude. Interestingly, there was more of it at the southern site, at the equatorial site, than at the northern site. And Chuck Klein proposed that as we move further north, there might be even less, and the best place to find oxygen-free material might be the polar region. Now, that is extrapolating from two data points, but better than one data point, right? Or no data point. It's not like this is astrophysics. Okay, next slide. The label release experiment. The label release experiment is the most contentious to this day, and to this day, Gil Levin, the PI of this experiment, is convinced that he discovered life and NASA is covering it up and participating in that cover-up. What did the label release do? It, organics were added to the soil, and the organics were labeled with C14, and then radio labeled CO2 was detected in the headspace. And sure enough, when organics were added to the soil, CO2 was released. It was exactly as expected if it was biologically consuming the organics. The results were in complete accordance with the pre-flight criteria for detecting life. And most interestingly, the reactivity was clearly affected by heating. There were three experiments where the sample was heated up for 3 hours at different temperatures, and it affected the reactivity. If it was heated for 160 degrees for 3 hours, the reactivity was eliminated. In fact, it was heated for 50 degrees for 3 hours, it was eliminated. But if it was heated to 46 degrees for 3 hours, it was reduced by a factor of 70, reduced to 70%. And if it was left in the reaction vessel at about 10 degrees C for several months, it was also eliminated. So there is a oxidant or some whatever process is causing this reactivity is temperature sensitive. It's destroyed by temperature, in contrast to the whatever process is causing the release of oxygen, which was not temperature sensitive. Again, we can look at how the results varied, and here the results were roughly constant at all landing sites, which led Chuck Klein, the Princeton Chief Scientist of the Biology Experiments, to suggest that what was happening was that the reaction was rate limited by the reactant, not by something in the soil, and that maybe only one of the seven organics being introduced into the soil was consumed, most likely candidate is the formate, and so the readings depend on the amount of formate added, and it's not necessarily a good indication of the oxidant in the soil. Nonetheless, if you take the amount of CO2 released in the LR experiment and translate that into oxygen in the surface, again, it's a very small number. It's a part per million using hydrogen peroxide as the model. So there's not a lot of oxygen. Not a lot of oxygen is required to explain the Viking results. Very small amounts. There may be potent oxidants like hydrogen peroxide, but not a lot is needed. Those oxidants presumably are the explanation for why there's no organics. Over the long pull of the millennia, or the long pull of billions of years, these slow, low-level oxidants have been eating away at any organic that's there, destroying them. And so hydrogen peroxide isn't going to kill you overnight, but if you saute in it for 3 million years, it's bad. That's the point here. Even at one part per million, 3 billion years will eat the organics. Next slide. So here's the suggested explanation from Chuck Klein for explaining this activity in the Viking results. One, you need a strong thermally stable oxidant to explain your Gex result, for example, shown here, 3 to 30 part per million. A strong thermally labile oxidant, like hydrogen peroxide at 1 part per million. And finally, I think the link to this, but you need a weak oxidant, like gamma Fe2O3, to explain the tail off in the LI results, which is sort of a little detailed, but the result is the point is you need more than one oxidant. Where are these oxidants coming from? The consensus opinion is that the fundamental source of oxidation is atmospheric hydrogen peroxide produced by UV light in the atmosphere of Mars. Ultraviolet light is breaking apart water molecules, creating radical species, just like it's doing on Earth. The ultraviolet light that creates the OH that takes care of odors on Earth and destroys organics in Earth's atmosphere is happening on Mars, and it's doing the same thing. It's, in fact, less efficient on Mars because there's a lot less water and less ultraviolet light on Mars, being further from the sun. The rate of UV production of hydrogen peroxide is estimated by models to be 2 × 10⁻⁹ molecules per square centimeter per second. That's not a lot. even if each of these hydrogen peroxide molecules quantitatively consumed an organic molecule, that would still take a long time to eat through a layer of skin or something. This is not a case where you should worry that if you put something out like a plastic or some organic material that it's going to fizz away as the oxidant consumes it. It will if you wait 3 billion years. Next slide. People have tried to simulate the binding results in the laboratory at various degrees of success. The best simulation is the paper by Quinn and Zen, in which they took titanium dioxide and modified it, soaked it in hydrogen peroxide. And they found that created two sets of oxidants on the titanium dioxide crystals. A layer of hydrogen peroxide essentially absorbed on the outside, which satisfies the LEX, the LR requirement for a hydrogen peroxide-like oxidant. And then a complex within the grains that was more stable and was able to satisfy the GEX requirement. So this, I would say, is our best laboratory simulation. It's not a perfect simulation. And Gil Levine is quick to point out that if you can't have a perfect chemical explanation for the biology experiments, then biology must be doing it. The logic for that isn't entirely clear, but that's his point. Yan et al. Have also suggested superoxide ions as a possibility. This is interesting because superoxide ions are biologically potent, but it's not clear that that's a good model. Next slide, please. What I want to do now is talk about measurements. How do we find out more about the biological effects of the Mars soil? Clearly, we're in a much better situation with the Moon because we sent test subjects there. Astronauts have gone there. We know the effects of humans, at least for short exposure. And we have samples in the on Earth, return to Earth. On Mars, we have neither of those. But we have in situ experiments, and the next in situ experiment, which will contribute to our understanding, will be the MECA experiment. Microscopy, electrochemistry, and conductivity analyzer, which will launch on the Phoenix mission in 2007. And this will be the next time we get to add water to Mars soil. And we will have 4 wet cells and have 4 opportunities to add water to the Mars soil. And if we add the water to the Mars soil, we will be able to look at the electrochemistry with ion-specific electrodes in the chambers. So we'll actually get a pretty good understanding of the solution chemistry for that site. We will also, for the first time, be able to look at the grain, at the dust size, at the very small particles. We will get better than ham lens resolution with optical and ATF. And then there will also be terminal and conductivity probes to understand the bulk problem. So this will be a very important step in our understanding of the chemistry of the soil. But I think that if we really understand the toxicity of the soil, we have to send organisms. The next slide. Something that I've been interested in a while is near-term missions to send whole organisms and look at their response to the environment. Now, obviously, the organism of choice is an astronaut. Jack Schmidt. Send him to Mars and the Moon and see how they survive. The best way to get data about humans is to test on humans. There's a lot of practical and ethical issues with using humans as a test subject. You work your way down in terms of practicality, and it seems like the best you can do on a near-term mission is probably to send a plant. Some of my best friends are a lot like plants, and so maybe you could say, oh, that's a good model for a human. But you really like to send, say, guinea pigs or mice or rats, but the logistics of doing that on a near-term mission are prohibited. And plant seems a good compromise. Next slide. Oh, by the way, that's just an artist's conception of what the plant might look like on a Mars mission. It's not meant as an engineering drawing. But when you talk to botanists, they don't want to send a rose anyway. They want to send something like this. This is a Rhabdopsis. And the great thing about plants like that is you can program them so that they can tell you how they feel in terms of response to stress. This is some work by Rob Farrell and Emily Sapal at University of Florida, showing how you can put in reporter genes and look at a plant's response to stress. So as you grow the plant on Mars in the soil, in the environment, you can look at it through a camera and understand its stress response just by imaging. It's a very powerful way of getting data from a complex organism that doesn't require a complex life support system to maintain it. I think that will be an important way to understand more about the biological effects of Mars on the next slide. And I think with that, I think we have to advocate for a sample return. Even a simple grab sample return, where a vehicle lands, has an arm, scoops out some dirt, puts it in a solid rocket launcher and sends it back. Not an elaborate multi-billion dollar sample return, but just a simple one. You can see that when you look at the results presented this morning for the lunar soil, how much more we can learn from a sample in the lab, right here in the microscope in the lab. The amount of information that we can get, the detailed studies that we can do from a return sample of the dust and the soil is just enormously more capable than what we can do on a mission. And the clearly a sample return is more complicated, more costly than a situ analysis, but the science return is much higher. I'd argue that in situ experiments like MECCA are needed, in situ growth experiments are going to ultimately be needed, but a sample return is also going to be needed in order to fully understand the Mars soil in preparation for spiral plot. We're going to have to work this into the robotic program. And there are science drivers for a grab sample, but I think that the real drivers for a grab sample are going to come from understanding the soil from a human health and safety point. That's going to be the driver for this mission, rather than science per se. I think the science community would want to have a more carefully selected sample involving more rocks and soil. Next slide, if there is one. Oh, yeah, I want to now talk a little bit about Mars-like soils on Earth. What do we have on Earth that we can use as analogs for Mars soil? I think this is a useful thing to do. As I mentioned, I want to talk about three areas. The laboratory analogs. We can make in the soil a good laboratory analog with respect to the oxygen chemistry of the soil, and that is, I think, hydrogen peroxide modified titanium oxide is the best bet on. Geological analog, the best work is that work that Carl Allen and others have done in terms of identifying palagonite from volcanoes and Hawaiian ice. These are spectrally and geologically probably the best analogs we have on Earth. They're weathered basaltic rocks, which is what we think we have on Mars, is weathered basaltic rocks. They're spectrally similar to the spectrum of rocks that the soils we see on Mars. There are some key differences that we know exist. For example, the fraction of magnetic particles is not the same. So this is not a good magnetic analog, but it's a good analog with respect to how the weathering processes are shaping the grains and the spectral properties of the soil. Biological and organic analogs, though, in terms of the oxygen, I think the best one is the atacama desert soils. So let me go to the next slide. First, here's palagonite, the weathered volcanic rock. This is a palagonite outcrop. Palagonite deposits in Iceland, found in Hawaii. It's the standard simulant for studies of Mars soil, particularly spectral or geological studies. I've been working with a group trying to come up with a standard simulant for Mars soil for the purposes of doing biological experiments like growth. This is not necessarily relevant at all in terms of biological experiments. This is chosen, and Carl can give us a lot more detail on it. Chosen because it looks spectral. And in fact, Kelly's thesis, PhD thesis, was to show, one of the results of the thesis was to show that the optical constants of this stuff line up exactly with the optical constants derived from the Mars dust storm. So optically, geologically, and in terms of source rock, this is probably a very good analog. But that doesn't mean that it tastes like Mars soil in terms of the oxidants or the organics. Next slide. A better place for that is probably the Atacama Desert. This is a view of the Atacama Desert from the shuttle. I always get dizzy when I see that. I see why they're afraid to go back to the shuttle. Probably just fall down. Yeah, get the Atacama. This is the desert. You can see why it's so dry. The coastal range blocks the coastal fogs and the Andes block moisture from this way. So the region here, which is a double rain shadow. Next slide, please. It's very dry. The driest, clearly the driest place we've ever studied on Earth. This scar is due to nitrate mining. It's an anomalous area because of huge accumulations of nitrate was mined in the early part of the last century. Next slide. These soils have three properties that make them organically and microbiologically Mars-like. The organics drop to low levels, oxidized organics increase relative concentration, no culturable microorganisms, no recoverable DNA, and the presence of some sort of oxidant, which is not chirally selective. Consumes both L and B amino acids, L and B sugars with equal alacrity. So we believe it's a non-biological consumption of organic material, similar to what we see in the Mars soil. So we have this suite of analogs, laboratory, geological, and biological analogs that we can study on Earth that I think are helping us understand the Mars soil. Next slide. That's the one. Maybe we still have time for questions.
Sure.
We have to move on because they're